This is Crime Binge.
Welcome to Crime Binge,
the podcast.
I'm Morgan.
And I'm Sarah.
And this week we are on episode 70, where we are covering J.C. Dugard.
And J.C. Dugard was an 11-year-old girl who was kidnapped by Philip and Nancy Garrido in 1991. She was held in captivity for 18 years before being rescued and reunited with her family.
Yeah, and I feel like this case is one that growing up, like, other than Elizabeth Smart, was just a case I always knew about.
Exactly. It was like one of the big ones.
Yeah, it was like always on the cover of the magazines when you're in the grocery store, like on People and Us and stuff like that. So this is definitely, I think, a well-known name, but not a well-known full story. Because even some of the stuff, like reading through, I was like, huh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so, me too. Like, I knew that she was kidnapped and that she was rescued a bunch of years later, but, like, I never really looked into all the details.
Yeah, same. I just, like, always saw the cover and always, like, just the pictures, you know? Mm-hmm. So it was fun to dig a little bit deeper into this case. Before we get into today's case, though, what are you binging this week, Sarah?
So this week I'm binging yet another podcast.
Nice.
And this one is an oral history of The Office.
Very cool.
And Corey and I are rewatching The Office right now. We're almost at the end. And so I thought it was only fitting to start this.
I feel like you're always rewatching The Office.
Well, yeah. I mean, it takes a while to get through. We've just been watching it like when we eat dinner. Okay, so we only watch like 3 episodes a day.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And it's only his second time watching it, to be fair.
Okay.
But this podcast is hosted by, I know I'm going to say his name wrong, by Brian Baumgartner, who plays Kevin on The Office. Mm-hmm. And unlike the Office Ladies podcast, which is a great podcast, instead of going through like each episode, this one is all of the, like, behind the scenes. So, like, the first episode is about, like, pitching the show. Mm-hmm. And the second one is about casting and all the different people who they got. And then it goes on about them, like, being canceled a trillion fucking times.
Yeah.
And all this stuff. And so it's all the, like, behind the scenes that you would never get from, like, the deleted scenes or from people just, like, doing interviews and stuff like that. And he gets all the guests. He obviously has all the characters, but he also gets all the behind the scenes people to be on it, like Ricky Gervais and Michael Shore and Greg Daniels. And it's just, it's really interesting. Like, there's a lot of fun facts that I had no idea.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, and there's 12 episodes out, and like, it again, it starts from the beginning, goes to the end. Final guest I just read, because I'm only on episode 6, is Billie Eilish, because she's like the biggest Office fan.
Yeah,
so that's hilarious.
That's fantastic.
But there's episodes about saying goodbye to Steve, about the last episode, about what it's like after Steve left and stuff like that. But
very nice.
It's very good, and it's very interesting, and it's put together almost like a story as opposed to an interview.
Cool. Very nice.
What are you binging this week, Morgan?
This week I'm not like actually binging all that much, to be completely honest. But I have been, over the past couple of weeks, trying to get through The Vow, which is the show about Nexium. And it's very slow.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of similar things.
It's interesting, to say the least. Because we've covered the Nexium cult.
Episode 4.
Yeah, very early on. And I feel like even in our, like, really early shitty episodes, that we covered more in that episode than they've covered in the, like, 9 or 10 hours that this show is.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. It makes none of them look good. Like, I think in their eyes, they think that, because it's like Sarah Edmondson mm-hmm. and that group, the people who came forward. And I think they think it's showing them in a more favorable light than it is. I think like Mark, who is one of the first guys that left, like, I think he's the cult leader, if we're being completely honest. Like, not really, I'm just kidding. But he was responsible for bringing so many people in and is now just like, I'm helping, but he was also in a cult before this cult.
Really?
So, I don't know. It's interesting. They got a second season.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Maybe they'll talk more about the, like, maybe interesting stuff in the second season. Yeah,
the thing is, it's just, like, at least because I still haven't even finished it, it's just, they're not really saying anything that Keith has actually done. And he did a lot of stuff. Like, yeah. I'm pretty sure he just got sentenced to life, like, today or something. I think I saw a, like, article mm-hmm. breaking. But I don't know. It's kind of weird. But it's still something I've been consuming, you know? So I feel like not everything we binge is gonna be good. And I thought I would share it because some true crime stuff is better than others.
And I did hear that there's another, like, it's just a documentary mm-hmm. and not a series called Seduced about it, which is better.
Okay, nice. I'll have to check that one out. I thought I heard of a different name for like some other type of documentary mm-hmm. as well that I wanted to check out because it is very interesting, but I don't know. It's just not my fav.
Yeah. I heard that they don't, like, really get into the super juicy stuff, which is, like, what you're kind of there for.
It's mostly just, like, one of the moms trying to get her daughter out
mm-hmm.
is what it seems like, which is interesting, but every episode is the same thing where she's like, I'm trying to get my daughter out, and her daughter's like, LOL, no. Like, that's what the whole thing is, so... It's interesting, but it's also could have been done in half the amount of episodes, and mm-hmm. they certainly don't need a second season to fill anything else out. So I'll be interested to see what they do with the second season.
Yeah.
All right, let's try and actually get into our episode. Before we do, we did want to make a couple of quick notes. We are recording this on Monday, November 2nd. Before anything has happened with the elections.
The day before?
Yeah, so we're still sweet, innocent baby angels. We haven't been hardened by any news that might have occurred this week. So if we sound too chipper for how you're mentally feeling this Friday, if you're listening to it the day it comes out, just know that we were in a totally different headspace than you are, listener.
I mean, honestly, no matter the outcome.
Yeah, exactly. No matter the outcome, it's going to be a wild week. I'm certain of it.
But we were both very responsible and we both voted.
Yes.
Early.
Yeah. I usually like to vote the day of, but I was like, I'm going to vote early. I still had to wait like 15 to 20 minutes and I never have had to wait before. Which is certainly, like, not a long time in any capacity. But I was like, wow, I'm glad to see that I actually had to wait today.
Yeah. I, on the other hand, had an absentee ballot. So instead of mailing it in, I wanted to be safe. And I just brought it into the drop box.
I had an absentee ballot as well. But I did not want to have any issues with my signature come up. Because I tried to close a bank previously, like a bank account. And they wouldn't let me because my signature wasn't the same. And I was like, I opened this account when I was 16. Of course it's not the same.
Yeah.
So I just didn't want any chances with the registration, like, being different. So I was like, I am physically voting.
Understandable.
Yeah. But we hope that you, if you are in America, also voted and that you are doing okay.
Right? We hope we all are.
Yeah. And we also wanted to say before we get into this that we are going to be talking about some sexual assault stuff. So if you are uncomfortable with that, this one might not be for you. But it's actually not a huge part of this case like you would think it would be. It yes. is part of the case, certain. I've said certainly. This is the third time now. Why? Who are you? Yeah.
Yeah, it's not the main part of the case. We don't go super into detail.
Yeah.
But it does include sexual assault and rape of a minor.
Yeah. So, just a heads up. But enough of us blabbing. Let's get into today's episode. So, we are going to start off with a little bit of history about our terrible captors. Philip Greg Garrido was born on April 5th, 1951, in Pittsburgh, California.
Yep.
He grew up in Brentwood, California, and graduated from Liberty High School in 1969. High school classmates said that he was good-looking and personable and was popular with girls, and he wanted to be a rock star, so pretty casual, like, high school stuff. Philip's father, Manuel Garrido, said that Philip was a good boy as a child, but he radically changed after getting into a serious motorcycle accident in 1968 as a teenager. After graduating high school, Philip started doing drugs, primarily crystal meth and LSD. At 18 years old, he had his first run-in with the law for drug possession. In 1972, 21-year-old Philip was arrested for drugging and sexually assaulting a 14-year-old girl, but the case never went to trial as the girl refused to testify. Just a year later, in 1973, Philip married Christine Murphy, a high school classmate of his, and Christine said that he was controlling and emotionally and physically abusive, especially when he was on drugs. He would get angry at her when she wouldn't want to participate in his sexual fantasies, such as orgies, and Philip even kidnapped her once when she tried to leave him, and she still has a scar on her face from being stabbed with a safety pin while he was trying to use it to gouge out her eyes, which is so disgusting and disturbing. Like,
the eyes are the worst. Eyes. Yeah.
Yeah.
In 1976, while on an LSD trip, Philip kidnapped another woman, 25-year-old Catherine Calloway, in South Lake Tahoe, California. He asked her for a ride, and Philip was handsome and charming, so she agreed. When they were almost to his destination, his mood changed and he grabbed her by the throat. He handcuffed her and drove her to Reno, Nevada, where he took her to a warehouse that had a mattress with a red silk sheet, porn magazines, and various dildos lined up on the table. He then proceeded to rape her for 5.5 hours. A police officer was doing rounds when he noticed a car strangely parked outside of the warehouse and that the lock was broken off the door. So he stopped and knocked on the door, only to be greeted by Philip. Catherine also then came to the door and asked the police officer for help, and Philip was then arrested. He ended up being charged and convicted of the crimes in both states, as well as in federal courts, for crossing state lines with her. In court, Philip also revealed that he would park his car in front of schools and would masturbate while watching girls. In 1976, a psychiatrist evaluated Philip and diagnosed him as a sexual deviant and a chronic drug user. The psychiatrist ordered that a neurological exam take place because his chronic drug use may be responsible for his sexual deviances. The exam by the neurologist came back as normal. On March 9th, 1977, Philip was convicted on kidnapping and rape, and on June 30th, he began serving a 50-year federal sentence at Leavenworth Penitentiary in Kansas. While Philip was in jail, his wife Christine divorced him. In prison, Philip began attending Jehovah's Witness groups and claimed to have found God.
While serving his sentence at Leavenworth, Philip met Nancy Bocanegra, who was visiting her uncle at the prison. So, not a great place to meet someone, I'll be honest, Nancy. Right? The two hit it off pretty quickly and were married at Leavenworth on October 5th, 1981. Philip was 30 and Nancy was 26. At the time, Nancy had no criminal record, but she was also part of the Jehovah's Witness faith.
And that's what really, like, connected them.
Yeah, that makes sense. That checks out. After serving 11 years of his 50-year sentence at Leavenworth, on January 22nd, 1988, Philip was transferred to Nevada State Prison, where he began serving his sentence of 5 years to life. He only served 7 months of this sentence before he was let out on parole on August 26, 1988. He convinced his psychiatrist in prison that he had found God, married a good woman, and was rid of his sexual fantasies. So his therapist recommended him for release. Apparently, after getting out of prison, he tracked down Catherine Calloway, his original rape victim, and visited her at work at a casino. He made small talk with her before saying, "Hope to see you again real soon, Katie," and he left. That was when Catherine realized who he was and that she had never been notified that he was released from prison. And I think this is really common, and I think that's super fucked up. I think it the is. Victim should be alerted that someone's out of jail.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they do now, but back then, definitely not.
Philip and Nancy lived together in Antioch and Contra Costa County in California. They lived with Philip's elderly mother, Pat, who was suffering from dementia. Nancy found a job as a nurse's aide, and Philip just got odd jobs around town. He was originally monitored very closely and later wore a GPS ankle bracelet for a period of time. He was also visited regularly by parole officers, sheriff's deputies, and federal agents. He was labeled as a low-risk sex offender. Nancy began helping Philip satisfy his fantasies of being with young girls. They would go to the park, and she would pretend to videotape him playing guitar, but in reality, she would be videotaping the young girls playing in the park. Philip would watch these videos on repeat, but eventually, they weren't enough for him, and he wanted to have a girl of his own. He convinced Nancy to go along with this plan and to help him capture a young girl. That, like, the recording of children in the park just bothers me so much for some reason. Mm-hmm. Like, talk about a gateway drug.
Definitely, like, yeah.
That just seems... I know what she was trying to do, quote unquote, but it just seems like a very bad step to take.
So now we're going to talk about J.C. Dugard. J.C. Lee Dugard was born May 3rd, 1980 to single mother, 32-year-old Terry Dugard. Terry had a brief relationship with a man named Ken Slayton in 1979, but the relationship ended, and Ken didn't even know that JC existed. Terry married a man named Carl Probin in 1989, and shortly after, they had a baby girl named Shayna. Carl was strict and opinionated, and JC was never really close to her stepfather. However, she was in love with her baby sister.
That makes sense. Mm-hmm. Like, I have a little sister now. Probably so stoked.
In September of 1990, the family moved from Arcadia, California in Los Angeles County to Myers, California, which is a rural town south of South Lake Tahoe. They moved here because they thought it would be a safer community to raise their family. And, like, just some examples on why they thought that they needed to move out of LA County was because on one occasion, JC was catcalled by a bunch of teenagers in a car, and on another occasion, she was offered drugs while walking to her bus stop. Yeah. And she's, like, under the age of 10 at this point.
Yeah.
So, JC's favorite color was pink, and she was described as a shy girl, but she made a lot of friends. On Sunday, June 9th, 1991, JC and some friends were walking home from a craft fair. She didn't notice that there was a gray car following her. Inside of the car was Philip and Nancy. Nancy later recalled Philip pointing at JC and saying, "That is the one I want." They followed her home and made a plan to kidnap her the next day. That night, JC told her mother that she was nervous about a school field trip later that week, and the next night her and her mother were supposed to go shopping for a new bathing suit for this trip. She wanted to shave her legs for the first time, and she was nervous about asking permission from her mom.
So wholesome. Mm-hmm. I remember when I was nervous, except I asked my dad, and I was like, I think in middle school by the time I asked to mm-hmm. shave my legs, but I was like, I don't know why. I was so stressed about it.
See, I never asked, like, but I had
an older sister
had a razor in the shower, and I just did it and then didn't tell anyone until someone noticed and they were just like, oh, okay. But I think I was in like the fifth grade.
Yeah. I don't know why it's such a big deal.
It's not.
But young me really thought it was as well, so I get that. On Monday, June 10th, 1991, JC's mother left early to go to work. So, 11-year-old JC, dressed in her favorite all-pink outfit, walked down the street to her bus stop to go to school. She only had 1 week left of school before graduating fifth grade and starting summer break, so she was probably just, like, wearing that outfit, stoked about getting ready to be out of school.
Hell yeah.
When she was about halfway up the hill to her bus stop, a gray car slowed down and approached her. She thought that the driver was going to ask for directions, but instead, the man inside, Philip Garrido, rolled down his window and shocked JC with a stun gun, knocking her to the ground. She tried to crawl on the sidewalk over to some bushes, but he grabbed her and pushed her inside of the vehicle, did a U-turn, and drove off.
Must have been so scary.
So scary. I had no idea about the stun gun thing, mm-hmm. and I was horrified when I read that, because can you imagine? That's, like, oh, my worst nightmare. Like,
yeah, and, like, an 11-year-old girl doesn't know what a stun gun is, and she's like, what is this attacking me, you know?
And it gets worse. JC's stepdad, Carl, was outside working in the garage and actually witnessed this abduction. With no time to go inside and find his car keys, he got on his bike and tried to chase the car down, but couldn't catch up. He yelled to one of his neighbors to call 911. Some of JC's classmates, who were already waiting at the bus stop, also witnessed the abduction, but no one was able to get a license plate number on the car. Once in the car, JC drifted in and out of consciousness as Philip's wife, Nancy, held her down while they made the three-hour drive back to their house in Antioch, which was 120 miles away.
Like, it's crazy that they drove that far just to find someone to kidnap. Like,
yeah.
I mean, it makes sense to try and cover your tracks and everything, but I'm like, that's dedication. Like,
yeah,
you're going there to do that. Like, it's not like, oh, I just see someone while I'm on my way to the store or something.
Exactly. Like, you were on the prowl for that reason. The only time that JC spoke while she was in the car was to inform the couple that her parents couldn't afford a ransom for her. At one point, she recalled hearing Philip laugh and say, "I can't believe we got away with it." By the time that they got back to the house, they had completely undressed JC, except for a butterfly ring that she had hid from her captors. Philip and Nancy put a blanket over her head and brought her into their backyard, which had multiple sheds and storage units in it. She was taken to one that was soundproof and was locked inside. Philip showed her the stun gun and said if she misbehaved, he would shock her again. That day, Philip made her shower with him and touch him, which was obviously the first time that JC had ever seen a naked man. He hugged her afterwards and she just sobbed into him. Then he left her naked and handcuffed in the shed, telling her that he had Doberman Pinscher dogs that were trained to attack her if she tried to escape. Sorry.
You're good. Within hours of JC's abduction, local and national media was covering the case. Over the next few days and weeks, dozens of volunteers helped in the search for her. Tens of thousands of flyers were posted around town and mailed across the country to businesses. The family sold t-shirts, sweatshirts, and buttons to raise money for the cause. JC's parents appeared on TV begging for their daughter's return. The whole town was covered in pink ribbons as a reminder of her disappearance and as a support to the family. JC's mother, Terry, founded a group called JC's Hope, which helped to direct the volunteer and fundraising efforts, and the family had quickly raised a reward of $25,000.
Yeah.
And I heard somewhere that two neighbors donated $10,000 each.
Oh, wow. That's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like because so many people, like, witnessed this abduction and there was no option of it to be, like, a runaway case,
mm-hmm.
that's why it got this immediate, like, national attention.
Definitely. Child Quest International and the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children helped in the search effort. And on June 14th, 1991, just 4 days after the abduction, her case was featured on America's Most Wanted. During the police investigation, the initial suspects were actually JC's stepdad, Carl, and her biological father, Ken.
Yeah, because it's usually someone you're related to, so it makes sense.
Yeah. This was actually when Ken found out that he had a daughter.
Yeah.
And he was quickly cleared from being a suspect.
Makes sense.
Carl, on the other hand, was the main suspect for, like, a while. And after cooperating with police, being interviewed multiple times, and passing 4 polygraph tests, he was also cleared. The police also never connected the fact that Philip's victim, Catherine Calloway, was also kidnapped from the same area.
Yeah, I mean, people are kidnapped all the time, though. And I feel like that's not crazy to not...
Yeah, especially the age together. Difference.
Yeah.
But it was something that, like, came up a lot because the police faulted so badly in this case.
Yeah, they definitely did when it comes to all of his, like, parole checks later, mm-hmm. for sure. But I think, like, this connection is, like, it's understandable a little bit.
So, JC was handcuffed for the first week of her capture. Within the first week, Philip raped her for the first time. When he was done, he told her that it wouldn't hurt as badly the next time if she didn't resist him. For the first few months, her only human contact was Philip, who would bring her fast food and milkshakes, talk to her, and sexually assault her. She was given only a bucket to relieve herself in, and also every once in a while he would bring her a bucket to wash up with.
Yeah.
Shortly into her capture, Philip provided her with a TV to watch, but she was not allowed to watch the news, so she wouldn't be aware of the national coverage of people searching for her.
Yeah, he had to isolate her.
Mm-hmm. And be like, no one cares about
you. Yeah.
About a month and a half later, JC was moved into a larger storage unit next door where she was handcuffed to the bed. This place was nicer than the last one because it had a couch, it had a bed because she had been sleeping on the floor the whole time,
yeah,
and a mini fridge in it, as well as 3 windows which were barred but she could see outside. And it was 2 months after being captured that Philip finally brought JC clothing to wear, as she had been kept naked since the day she was taken.
That's so awful.
Mm-hmm. You have nothing to cover yourself up with.
To, like, protect yourself in any way, like, mm-hmm. in a way that you would feel comfortable with. You're, like, just at the mercy of this man.
Yeah, I feel vulnerable when I'm naked in my own house. Yeah. Like,
also, if the only woman you feel like you can have deep talks to are an 11-year-old child, then sir, you need help. But
he needs a lot of help.
Yeah, he does. This guy is an asshole. Philip would have periodic methamphetamine binges. I can't say that whole word. Meth, guys. Which he called run. During these runs, Philip would make JC dress up in adult clothing and put on makeup while cutting pornographic images out of magazines. He also spent a lot of time just talking to her, telling her that the demon angels let him take her to help with his sexual problems because society had ignored him. He said that he was a chosen servant of God, and he would also make her listen to voices that he said would come from the walls. And these runs would also end by Philip sobbing to JC, apologizing for what he had done, and then he would switch gears and threaten her, saying that he would sell her to people that would put her into a cage. And these runs would sometimes last for days. In January of 1992, 7 months into her capture, JC was introduced to Philip's wife, Nancy, who brought her a stuffed animal and chocolate milk. Nancy started off as being nice to her, apologizing and acting motherly, which JC enjoyed as she was longing for a mother figure. But as time went on, she said that Nancy was just as manipulative and cruel as Philip. She said that Nancy was evil and twisted, and she would be cold to JC and express her jealousy of her, saying that the situation they were in was all JC's fault. Which, like, no, it's your and your husband's fault.
Mm-hmm.
Philip also told JC that Nancy was jealous of her, and it was her job to make Nancy like her.
Again, an 11-year-old.
Yeah, you are jealous of an 11-year-old that you kidnapped. So really think about your actions there, guys. For a short period in April of 1993, Philip went back to jail for failing a drug test, and Nancy took his place as JC's guard. When Philip came back from jail this time, he began being even more religious. The neighbor, Patrick McQuaid, who was just a boy at the time, met JC through the fence of the Garrido's backyard shortly after the kidnapping, on one of the first times that she was allowed outside after being kidnapped. He later recalled that she introduced herself as JC, and when he asked if she lived there or if she was just visiting, she replied that she lived there. Philip saw her talking to this boy and took her back inside. Shortly after, he built an 8-foot privacy fence just so no one could see into the backyard. He also put a tent out for JC if she wanted to be outdoors. On two different occasions, the couple bought JC a kitten that would disappear after she created a connection with it. She also kept a journal while being locked up and wrote about the kittens in it. When the couple discovered that she was using her own name in the journal, they made her tear it out and destroy the page. From then on, she was no longer allowed to use her own name. Philip made her choose a new name, and JC chose the name Alyssa, after Alyssa Milano, and this was because she was one of, like, from her favorite show, Who's the Boss? Which is very cute, like, Alyssa Milano.
Mm-hmm.
From there on out, she was only referred to as Alyssa. Philip would also constantly tell her that the world was a very dangerous place and was filled with sexual predators that were even worse than him, and that if she tried to escape, her fate would be met with one of these other men.
3 years into the abduction, JC was finally allowed freedom from wearing the handcuffs for longer periods of time. On Easter Sunday in 1994, she was given a home-cooked meal for the first time. 3 years.
Yeah. Can you imagine, like, how sick you probably feel after eating that much fast food for that long?
Mm-hmm. It's insane. He also brought her an Easter basket full of candy this day. And also, on this day, Philip and Nancy informed JC that they believe she was pregnant. She was in shock. And the only way that she connected pregnancy and sex was through watching television. And the only thing that she knew about babies was when she was helping her mother with her baby sister. And the 13-year-old girl was, in fact, 4.5 months pregnant at the time.
Yeah, you have to think she hasn't been in school to actually get that sexual health education, so has no fucking idea what's happening.
Exactly. The couple had her watch pregnancy and childbirthing programs in order to prepare her for the birth of her child. Late into the pregnancy, Philip came into the room telling JC that there may be a raid on the house. He made her cram under the back seat of their van, and the couple drove her to an empty trailer. In this trailer, she was able to use a working toilet and sink for the first time since she was taken. They made her stay the night there before taking her back to her own house.
Yeah.
The next evening. Without any medical attention, and only with the help of Philip and Nancy, JC gave birth on August 18th, 1994, to a baby girl named Angel. And apparently during the birth, Philip was like the main person. And after she was in labor for hours, he realized that the umbilical cord was wrapped around the neck.
Mm.
And so he like literally reached in and fixed it so she could like properly give birth. So he was like, yeah. I was like, how do you know that stuff?
That's foul.
Mm-hmm. Philip provided JC and her child with clothing, diapers, and food. And he and Nancy came around more and visited her more often, and they were much kinder to her than before.
Yeah. Just a few years later, when JC was 17, she became pregnant by Philip again. During this time, Philip built an even higher fence to hide the backyard, but let JC and her baby go outside. But they were not allowed to leave the backyard. I always think it's interesting that he, like, just kept building higher fences, because I feel like as a neighbor, I would be very suspicious of someone who was doing that.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Something that was hard to, like, figure a place to write in, mm-hmm. was kind of like the configuration of the backyard. And it was a large lot that had a bunch of, like, sheds and stuff. And,
oh, yeah, I've seen, like, top-down pictures mm-hmm. of it.
And the way that he, like, tricked his parole officers
mm-hmm.
was that he built a fence around just, like, the regular part of the backyard. And then if you went past that fence, he had another fence, and that's where he kept the sheds and stuff where he mm-hmm. kept JC.
Okay. Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So, on November 13th, 1997, JC again gave birth to another baby girl, who she named Starlet. She took care of her daughters by using information that she learned while watching TV, and did everything she could to protect them from Philip, who would still go on his meth runs and scream his rants and weird religious lectures at them. JC also coped with captivity by planting flowers in the garden outside and homeschooling her children as much as she could. After her second daughter was born, Philip stopped sexually assaulting JC, but he still had his violent bouts of rage. He became even more obsessed with his religion and claimed that he could talk to angels. Whenever he would get violent with her, he claimed that the angels made him do it. During this time, JC's mother, Terry, was still on the search to find her daughter. She would hold frequent garage sales and other fundraising attempts in order to pay for private investigators and for the printing of the flyers she would still send out across the country. And this time, it included a sketch of what JC would possibly look like as a teenager. She also organized an annual vigil in order to keep up the awareness of JC's disappearance. At one point, Philip told JC that in order to please Nancy, she was to call her mother, and that she was to teach her children that Nancy was their mother as well, and she was just their older sister, which is, like, really common in these abduction cases. Mm-hmm.
So again, JC and her children were free to move about the backyard, but Philip's mother, Pat, still live there, and she saw them. And JC would even go inside the house to help Nancy help with her, since she had dementia and other problems.
Yeah.
And Philip just told his mom that they were all of his children from previous relationships, and they were just visiting.
Yeah.
And, like, I heard that she, like, you know, grew up on the farm in the early 1900s, and she was like, it's not common or not uncommon for people to be outside all the time, you know?
Yeah, especially when you have dementia.
Exactly.
Like, it's pretty easy to pull the wool over your eyes.
In 1998, that would have been the year that JC graduated high school. The high school that she would have attended put her photo in the yearbook with the caption, "Even though you may not be walking with us down the graduation aisle, you will always be walking with us in our hearts." In the summer of 1999, Philip brought Nancy, JC, and her children out in public for the first time. He took them to a carnival, and nobody recognized JC, as obviously she looked much different now, and the couple, like, cut her hair short and made her dye it brown and everything like that.
Yeah, people didn't recognize me with my pink hair.
Exactly.
You know, so.
And since this trip went well, the day trips continued.
Yeah.
In 2001, Philip got a new parole officer who, after reviewing his file, then labeled him as low risk, and this meant that he received even less supervision from the parole office than before. In 2002, the fire department responded to a call of a child with a shoulder injury that occurred in the Garrido's pool. Unfortunately, this wasn't reported to the police because, kind of, why would they? Where there was no record of a swimming pool and not supposed to be children at the property as part of Philip's parole. And so, I mean, if it would have been reported to the police, there could have been a chance that they were rescued. But in reality, there's no reason to report it to the police.
Right.
Philip eventually started operating a print shop from his house called Printing for Less. JC developed an interest in the computer, and she was good at graphic design, so he would give her jobs, and he made JC work there as the graphic artist. Two customers later said that they had worked with JC, both in person and over the phone. They said that she was nice and did excellent work, but never revealed her true identity to them or spoke about her abduction or life. She kept up the facade that Nancy and Philip were just her parents, and she also had the access to the company phone and email at this time.
Yeah, I think at that point you're just probably so, like, indoctrinated that you're never going to see your family again that you, like, don't even really think that it can happen, so you don't think to try and free yourself.
And it's like, what if it goes wrong?
Yeah.
Like, what is he going to do to me?
Exactly. In November of 2006, one of Philip's neighbors called 911 to inform police that there were tents in the backyard with children living inside of them. The neighbor also said that Philip was a religious psychotic with sexual addictions. So I don't think Philip was being as discreet as he thought he was being.
Right.
If the neighbor was like, yo, this guy is fucking crazy. A police officer went to the house and spoke with the 55-year-old Philip for about 30 minutes. Philip said that there were no children on the property, and the officer told him that there would be a code violation if there were people living in the backyard, but then he just left. He didn't look up Philip's record or ask to look around in the backyard. At this point, JC was 26 years old and had been captive for 15 years. Philip was still continuing his religious outbursts, and the clients at his printing shop even noticed the change in his behavior as the years went on. He would show clients a device he made to communicate with God, and even had some of his clients sign a contract saying that Philip had the ability to control sound with his mind, and that they had been a witness to him doing so. In 2000, the prices must have been great at this printing shop.
Oh, yeah.
In 2007, he started a blog called Voices Revealed, where he posted about his experiences and theories. In 2008, he officially incorporated his own religion, which he called God's Desire. He received a loan of $18,000 from an elderly neighbor to start this church. The next year, Philip came about this idea that he could help other offenders with the same problems as him if they only adapted to his religion and used his device to communicate with God and the angels.
It's so funny.
Yeah. And fun fact, due to Jessica's Law, which was a law brought out by the death of Jessica Lunsford in 2005, Philip was again forced to wear an ankle monitor.
And I just think it's great when you do cases and you run into, like, other cases that you know having effect on these new people. Like, it makes you feel good that something good has come from this.
Yeah, that there was some change actually implemented. Mm-hmm. It's very nice to see. On August 24th, 2009, Philip visited the San Francisco office of the FBI, where he left a 4-page essay detailing his religious beliefs and how he cured his criminal sexual behaviors. He also said that his work could help other sexual predators by controlling human impulses that drive humans to commit dysfunctional acts.
Just, you know, casually walking up to the FBI.
Yeah.
On the same day, Philip, accompanied by his two young daughters, visited a University of California, Berkeley police office. He spoke with a special events manager, Lisa Campbell, about permission to hold an event on campus as part of his God's Desire religion and to spread the word. Lisa Campbell thought that Philip's behavior was erratic and that the two girls seemed submissive and sullen. She asked Philip to make an appointment for the next day, so he left his name and made an appointment for 2 p.m. the next day. Lisa then asked her colleague, Officer Allie Jacobs, to run a background check on Philip. She did and discovered that Philip was a registered sex offender who was on parole for kidnapping and rape. Officer Jacobs attended this appointment the next day, and Philip again brought the two girls along with him. She thought that the girls seemed extremely pale, like they hadn't really been exposed to sunlight, and that their behavior was very unusual. She knew that he was violating the terms of his parole and decided to call the parole office, leaving a voicemail expressing her concerns. Two parole officers drove to Philip's house later that day after hearing the message from Officer Jacobs. They searched the house, only finding Nancy and Pat there, and they drove Philip back to the parole office. Philip told the officer that the girls who accompanied him to the university were daughters of a relative and he had permission to be with them and they had since gone home. Even though part of Philip's parole was that he was not allowed to be associated with minors, obviously, and he was also not allowed to travel more than 15 miles from his home without permission, and the university was 40 miles away.
Yeah.
Nothing was done about these violations, and the officers just drove him back home, but they did tell him to report back to the office the next day to discuss his trip to the university.
So on August 26, 2009, Philip arrived at the parole office with Nancy, JC, and her two daughters, which I feel like he did that for a reason. I feel like he kind of realized his time was up and was like, we're gonna turn ourselves in, you know?
See, I feel like kind of in the back of his mind he felt that, but his, like, mindset and what he told JC and stuff was like, if we give them a convincing story, they'll stop bothering us.
Yeah. It's just such a stupid idea I'm just, like, trying to give him the benefit of the doubt, basically. The offer offers. Okay. The officers separated Philip from the girls in order to figure out their identity. Philip had previously given JC a rundown of what to say and do and told her that if she felt intimidated, to just ask for a lawyer. JC, who told the officers that her name was Alyssa, informed them that the girls were her daughters. She, along with her daughters, said that Philip was a changed man and was good with the children. JC told the police that she was an abused wife, hiding from her husband, which is why she was staying with Philip. She also became very agitated and defensive when the police kept questioning her. After being interrogated, Philip eventually revealed that he had kidnapped and raped JC. It was only after this that she finally revealed her true identity. Philip and Nancy were placed under arrest, and an FBI agent let JC call her mother, Terry. Can you just, like, imagine what that phone call was probably right? like? Concord Police Sergeant Todd Stroud was one of the first officers to talk to JC's daughters. I spent some time talking with them, getting them some food, and trying my best to make them feel a little more at ease. He said that he then met with JC and reassured her that her daughters were being well taken care of. As the news got out that JC and her daughters had been found, outside the police station became a media frenzy. Officer Stroud realized that he needed to take JC and her daughters someplace safe, so he snuck them out the back and took them to the local Hilton Hotel. The girls, who by this time were 14 and 11 years old, were taken back to the hotel with their mother in just the clothes on their backs. JC's youngest daughter, Starlet, told the officers that she wanted her hermit crabs that she had been taking care of, so Stroud, along with the police chaplain, Tim Grayson, came up with a plan and retrieved the aquarium holding the hermit crabs, covered it in towels, and brought it to their hotel room. I was declared Royal Crab Carrier number 1, and Tim was Royal Crab Carrier number 2. When I read that, I was literally, like, crying. I was like, this is the nicest thing I've ever heard.
It's so sweet. So, JC was reunited with her family shortly after, and she was actually reunited with her mother, Terry, the same day she was rescued, as her mother rushed to the hotel after hearing the news. The police chaplain, Tim Grayson, who was Royal Crab Carrier number 2, said about the reunion, "They opened the double doors, and JC went walking through. We heard the shout of her mother, 'My baby!' And then her arms were open. There wasn't a dry eye in the house." Her family spoke out, saying that the reunion was going well, even though they were taking it slow. Her stepdad said that JC and her daughters were both in good health and intelligent. And JC's aunt, Tina, said that JC's daughters were clever, curious, articulate girls who had a bright future ahead of them. And, you know, JC did all of that homeschooling herself by just going on the internet and, like, watching Sesame Street and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
The day after Philip's arrest, he did a phone interview from the jail with a local television station, and this interview pissed me the fuck off.
Yeah.
So in this interview, he said, "In the end, this is going to be a powerful, heartwarming story. My life has been straightened out. Wait till you hear the story of what took place in this house. You're going to be absolutely impressed. It's a disgusting thing that took place with me at the beginning, but I turned my life completely around." And he also claimed that once JC gave birth, that he became a changed man and he never assaulted his daughters, which JC also said was true.
Yeah, but he did have to assault her to have the second one.
Yes. And it's like, he's basically just making the whole thing about him. And yeah. Like, you'll see how great I am because I changed my life. On August 28th, 2009, Nancy and Philip both pleaded not guilty to charges of rape, kidnapping, and false imprisonment. Philip did not receive any bail opportunities while awaiting trial, but Nancy did. But her bail was set at $30 million.
Good.
Nancy's attorney stated that they were potentially facing a life sentence, but wanted to work with the state to potentially reduce it to around 30 years. The attorney said that the prosecution knew that Nancy had been manipulated by both Philip and drugs during the period of the kidnapping, so she should receive some consideration about that, and her attorney used examples of Stockholm Syndrome and the Patty Hearst case to back up his statement. Yeah, maybe at the time of the kidnapping, but what about for the 18 goddamn years after?
Yeah.
On April 7th, 2011, at the start of the trial, the Garridos shocked everyone by pleading not guilty. After a bunch of legal drama surrounding the grand jury, they eventually settled with a plea deal, and the couple pled guilty to kidnapping and rape by force on April 28th, 2011. Philip was sentenced to 431 to life in prison, and Nancy was sentenced to 36 years to life. Both of them will be eligible for parole in 2034. Philip is currently 69 and Nancy is 65. JC did not attend the sentencing hearing, but sent her mother with a message to read aloud to the court. And I also read that his first victim, Catherine Calloway, attended all of the hearings and everything.
Nice. That's awesome. Hopefully they won't be alive by that, but by that time for parole. But I also just am confident that our justice system won't release them. But
it's like,
I don't know.
I get, you know, if you're sentenced to 36 years to life and you're eligible for parole after, what, that's like 30-something years. Mm-hmm. But if you're sentenced to 400 years, you shouldn't ever be eligible for parole. Like, that's stupid.
In July of 2010, the state of California settled with JC and awarded her $20 million. This was to compensate for, quote, various lapses by the corrections department that contributed to Dugard's continued captivity, ongoing sexual assault, and mental and or physical abuse. And over the years that JC was in captivity, Philip had over 60 face-to-face meetings with parole officers at his house, and none of them checked the backyard. But the next year, JC filed a lawsuit against the United States, accusing them of failing to properly monitor Philip when he was out on parole, and that he should have been arrested multiple times for multiple parole violations and never was. This lawsuit was rejected, saying that JC had not been kidnapped by the time that Philip was placed on parole, and that there was no way to know that she would have become his victim.
This makes me so angry.
Yeah. Since her rescue, JC has written two memoirs: A Stolen Life, which was released in 2011, and Freedom, My Book of First, which was released in 2016. She also started a foundation called JAYC, which stands for Just Ask Yourself to Care, which is their name and their message. This foundation helps families connect together and heal after trauma or crisis. It was suggested later on that JC suffered from Stockholm Syndrome after being locked away for so long. In a news interview with Diane Sawyer in 2016, JC addressed this, saying, "The phrase Stockholm Syndrome implies that hostages cracked by terror and abuse becomes affectionate towards their captors. Well, it's degrading, you know. Having my family believe that I was in love with this captor and I wanted to stay with him, I mean, that is so far from the truth that it makes me want to throw up. I adapted to survive my circumstance, which I feel like is true of all of the people who get captured, you know, like everyone always thinks that they feel this kindness towards their captor, and I'm sure it's just survival mode, you know?
Yeah, like, I'm sure that they're very, that there are cases of it, but I think it's very fewer than, than they talk about.
Yeah, for sure. In the same interview, she talked about her daughters and if they ever wanted to visit their father. I want them to make their own choices in life, and if that's something they need to do, then, you know, I would, then, you know, I wouldn't be okay with it, but I wouldn't let them not do it. And today, JC is 40 years old, and her daughters are 26 and 22, which is crazy because her daughters are, like, the same age as us. And
yeah, like I'm 26.
Yeah, like, this case has been going on forever, it feels. But yeah, that was JC Dugard.
Yeah, it's a big one. I've been waiting to do it.
I know, and I, because it's such a big one, have just been like, no, let's not do it yet, because, like, that and Elizabeth Smart are such big, intense cases that are just so well known. They stress me out when they're that well known.
Yeah, you're like, everyone's gonna criticize my research.
Yeah, it's spooky. But we hope that you guys enjoyed that episode. And if you did, leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts.
Also, check us out on social media. We're on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Crime Binge or Crime Binge Podcast.
Yeah.
And you can also check out our website, which is crimebinge.com. And we'll post pictures there as well. And you can also leave a submission about any recommendations on stories or submit your own story for us to read.
Yes. I was gonna say something else and then immediately forgot, so instead I will say, and
keep on binging.
Bye.
See ya.
Sorry, Morgan.
Oh, I was just gonna make like a shitty comment like, we'll all survive after this election.
Yeah, also that. Let's hope that this podcast will even be released on Friday, that there hasn't been a nuclear explosion or something.